The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, a humiliating defeat in Islington North as Manchester City breach Arsenal's red wall three times in the first 40 minutes. Calls from everywhere for the club to decide who the new manager is, even from the current manager. Elsewhere, no jumper, no jacket and merciless substitutions as Big Dunk gets a point at Old Trafford. Liverpool keep on keeping on despite playing two games every day in December, while Norwich hold Leicester and ruin the title race. Chelsea slip up again and Jose wins ugly at Wolves. We've got the Football League, including a great Cardiff comeback and no shots on target in Stoke. In Scotland, Alfredo Morelos gives us some Christmas nostalgia by getting sent off. And there's fun in Spain as Thibaut Courtois goes up for a corner in the 95th minute. We'll round up all of Europe, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Dragged in for this early record, Philippe Auclair, how are you? It's
right.
8:10. I mean, like, normal people get up at this time. Everyone's moaning at me.
Well, we were here much earlier than that, Max. That's really unfair.
Okay.
There's such a thing as public transport as well in London.
I know.
Early in the morning.
You're all heroes. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Max.
Lovely to see you.
Yeah, I'm not as sleepy as Philippe.
No. And, you know, when we tweeted out for questions, only 50% about what you eat on your Christmas plate. We'll get to that. Hey, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
You had to think about it.
Yeah, I did.
Let's start at the Emirates then. Arsenal 0, Manchester City 3. Hot Take says, which devastating defeat would have hurt Jeremy Corbyn more? Tim Stillman, not sure what Arsenal have come into this game trying to do. They're not playing a deep block. They're not playing on the counter. They're not compact. They're not pressing. It literally is just some blokes on a field. 3-0 up at half time. The game was done. Kevin De Bruyne with two crackers, an assist, and denied a first half hat trick by a brilliant save from Bernd Leno. You were there, Philippe. How was it?
This might explain my state this morning. How was it? The match lasted, I think, 93 seconds. There was a really, really, really good attack by young Gabriel Martinelli, who looks actually a prospect and was probably one of the few motives of satisfaction. And then afterwards, it was the Mesut Özil Jubilee game. I don't know how you call it. There was no game. The amount of space left to Manchester City was just crazy. I think they could have kept the ball for 90 minutes if they decided to, because there was absolutely no pressure whatsoever, and they could pass the ball, you know, Otamendi to Fernandinho to Rodri to whatever, and they did that quite well. But I really wouldn't take any... I mean, I haven't learned anything about Manchester City that I didn't know. I don't think it's necessarily the great rebirth of the team. It was a training game. It was embarrassing. I think Tim Stillman's description was really fitting. I think the only good thing for the people who were at the game was the fact that in the very last seconds, suddenly the people who had stayed, about half of the public, I would say, started singing, "We love you, Arsenal, we do," which means that the fans do understand that it's down to something much, much deeper than the players who were on the pitch, and that it's time to regroup very quickly.
Sounds like another...
Yes, I know. I was about to say it. But the National Executive Committee of Arsenal Football Club hasn't met yet, apparently, and the decision hasn't been communicated. It was quite extraordinary to hear Ljungberg talking after the game and saying that, basically, could you please take me out? Could you please put somebody else in my position because I can't cope with it?
Yeah, or
it's astonishing.
I mean, it is astonishing, and you look at... You compare to what Daniel Levy did, and I was certainly not... You know, I'm eating words every time Tottenham do well, or thinking actually Mourinho was not a bad choice. The fact that when Spurs had a problem, they knew what to do. They knew they had to change it right then, right there. Get this done, whatever it cost. And Arsenal, Lars, have just sacked Emery, which probably wasn't a terrible idea, and have had no idea what to do, or have a shortlist of 100, or
absolutely. And I think, you know what, if I was an Arsenal fan, that would kind of worry me more than what happened at the weekend. Very because they are, if you look at the team player for player, they're maybe, what, the 6th, 7th best team in the league, and they have some absentees as well, so maybe not even that yesterday. And you play a Man City team who on their day are still absolutely magnificent, and you have a interim manager who maybe isn't the manager at this level, and you're in a bit of disarray, and okay, you play City, you get tonked, you take your medicine, you move on, it happens. But I get more worried for Arsenal's sake when you see the sort of reports of the shortlist they apparently have, not just because it's not very short, but also because there's so many names there, they've got nothing in common. Like if you have Allegri and Arteta and Ragnik on the same shortlist, the people in charge have no idea what they're doing. They have no concept of what the team should look like, what kind of football they should play, what should be the identity of this team. If those names are on the same shortlist, that's like an admission of, like, we don't know.
But
like,
is there a way of saying, you know, there's more than one way of skinning a cat, right? You want a good manager. Does it actually matter?
But I don't think it's binary. I don't think a manager is either good or bad. I think managers are good at different things and suitable for different situations. And if you have a short list of people who have nothing in common, you have to start asking questions of whether the people who are making these decisions know what they're doing. The caveat here being that I'm assuming that the names mentioned in the press are accurate. They might not be. You never know with these things. But it seems a little bit worrying.
When it comes to choosing the new manager, the first thing you should take into account is the players you've got, the type of squad you've got, and then you think of a manager who can do some work with this squad. And when I look at it at the moment, there are very few managers who could do anything with that squad because it is so unbalanced, and also because it is also riddled with injuries and two important players. You know, when you think of the players, and they're all missing in the same line, by the way, in defence. Plus Dani Ceballos, whom I think is really missed as well this time.
What's happening with the fullbacks? Is there some sort of pox that sort of only affects Arsenal fullbacks?
I don't know. And also you have to say that looking back, you think the decision to let Nacho Monreal leave as he did, which is, you know, a very nice thing, gesture from the club, but heaven above, he would be badly needed now. Can play centre back, can play left back, and so forth. So again, yes, you wonder. I mean, would you go for would you want to go with the young ones? Okay, if you go with the young ones, you've got to take a manager who is used to work with young players and know how to get the best of them. Do you want somebody who is going to be the ferryman, as the Italians say, so take to the end of the season and do a job a la Rafa Benitez, who, by the way, would be my favorite mm-hmm. candidate, mm-hmm. and who is at the moment not working because the season has finished in China. So we haven't got a clue of that. And even more than that, we don't have a clue of the people who are going to take the decision. We think it's Raul Sanjehi, okay, on his own, with the help of whom? Edu, who is in charge? Nobody seems to know, really. It's not Josh Kroenke.
It's a very good question. Can we talk about Mesut Ozil? Because, Mark, Philippe scoffs in a very Gallic way. Because so many on the sort of the football dinosaur wing of football punditry have been very critical of Ozil for so long, I have wanted to defend him, not necessarily because he's been good, but just because I feel that's where I should sit on the scale of punditry. And he's a beautiful footballer when he gets it right. But he doesn't seem to be getting it right.
I can't remember the last time he got it right now. It feels like
last season.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a long time ago. And I just don't understand why he wasn't alone in this. But, you know, you can't play like that against sort of Manchester City. He was there on the pitch, but he wasn't really there. I mean, there was no pressing of Rodri to try to sort of make it uncomfortable for him. There didn't appear to be any great desire to get on the ball and actually try to make things happen for Arsenal. Of course he will take the criticism because of that big contract that he's got, because of his status as a World Cup winner. He should be one that Arsenal are looking to when they're in this kind of trouble to drag them out of it. But I also feel that it's very difficult for the individual to shine bright when the collective is completely broken, which is maybe another issue. And just going on to the sort of melee that Arsenal are in, you know, when they went back to appointing the last manager, it was Arteta all the way until somebody had a different idea at the last moment to go for Unai Emery. Then Mignolet was in and was kind of this new vision of where he wanted to take the club, and they've moved away from that. So, I mean, Ozil was not the only problem there by a long way, but it was a terrible performance from him yesterday.
Can you be an attacking creative midfielder and not defend anymore? I mean, is that a possible thing to be in football?
It looks terrible when De Bruyne is playing the way that he did in sort of a similar-ish kind of role.
Yeah, and that's the point, isn't it? You look at great attacking, you know, defence starts up front, right?
I would say, I'm trying to think of examples in the Premier League of number 10s. I think perhaps Christian Eriksen is not perhaps the greatest defender presser in the world, but he still tries.
But he tracks back, doesn't he?
Yeah.
James Maddison perhaps is not, but actually James Maddison does try.
Yeah.
But Maddison would also have Ndidi and Tielemans and others behind him, where if you haven't got that sort of midfield responsibility behind you and that cover, then you have to do more as the number 10, and he didn't, that's for sure.
Duncan Alexander, lovely stat from him. Ben Foster and Thibaut Courtois have together had more shots on target than Mesut Ozil this season. Off the pitch, you mentioned the season ending in China for Rafa Benitez. It also seems to have ended for Arsenal. China's state broadcaster CCTV on Sunday removed Arsenal's Premier League game against City from its broadcast schedule, played a replay of Wolves Spurs after they played the Man United Everton game. Following Mesut Ozil's
much better game, by the way.
But following Mesut Ozil's messages that criticised the country's policy towards its Muslim Uyghur minority, the Global Times newspaper said on its Twitter account on Sunday that CCTV took the decision after Ozil's comments on Saturday had disappointed fans and footballing governing authorities, the quote goes. Obviously, after this, Arsenal came out and made a comment saying they distanced themselves from Mesut Ozil's comments because they wanted to remain apolitical. Arsenal hadn't distanced themselves from Hector Bellerin's political post saying, don't vote for Boris Johnson. This is complicated for Arsenal because they have business interests. I mean, it isn't, right?
I think that the way that they approached it, it felt really that they were scared and they were giving in. It was not as if they had said, we do not have an opinion about what Mesut has said. All our players have got a right to their opinions. They are not necessarily, or they are not the opinion of the club. If they had said that, I think everybody would have said, yeah, fair enough. Mesut Ozil has got every right to say what he wants to say, as just as Hector Bellerin or others. But they looked quite they looked as if they were caving in, basically.
But the context here, I guess, is the problem the NBA recently had
with
the Chinese, where I believe it was the general manager of the excellently named Houston Rockets who tweeted in solidarity of the Hong Kong protesters, and the Chinese companies ended their association with the
they pulled the game as well.
And franchise in question. And I thought, in a weird way, this was almost the most significant thing to happen over the weekend, if you go in a slightly bigger perspective, because I think it's the first sort of obvious run-in we've had in the Premier League with the sort of Chinese business interests, because we talk a lot about Qatar and sports washing and this sort of thing, and the Qataris get a lot of stick, and rightly so. Thing about it is, you can ignore the Qataris. It's completely possible for a Western country to just decide not to deal with Qatar. They're small, it's fine. Whereas with China, it's different. China is not just a place where you go on lucrative pre-season tours. It's such a huge market. It's an increasingly significant economic force. And the way things work in that country, in that society, is if the government gets annoyed with you, you have a huge problem. We had this in Norway a number of years back when the Nobel Committee gave the Peace Prize to a dissident named Liu Xiaobo, and even though the Nobel Prize Committee is completely independent of the Norwegian government, like, the Norwegian government had huge diplomatic problems with China for years and years after. I can understand in a way why Arsenal are so paranoid about this, because they are a business at the end of the day, and in a perfect world they'd stand up for all that's good, but you know, we're not in a perfect world.
I mean, in terms of the economics, the TV deal is worth about $8.75 million per year per club,
right,
in the Premier League, okay, with the Chinese, with CCTV.
So that's not huge. I mean, in relative terms, not huge.
No, it's not. It's not colossal.
No,
but it's different if every Chinese company decides that they can't be associated with the club
anymore.
Sure.
Now, the UN and human rights groups estimate that between 1 million and 2 million people, mostly ethnic Uyghur Muslims, have been detained in harsh conditions in Xinjiang as part of what Beijing calls an anti-terrorism campaign. China has repeatedly denied any mistreatment.
Which is mind-blowing, and I guess is something we should be talking about more, and I do recommend finding some space in your day to read up on the subject.
Absolutely. Triton is back on the pitch. Kevin De Bruyne, just a joy, isn't he? As I said earlier, it's so annoying that Leno makes that save, because it would have been a tremendous...
It was a tremendous save.
It was a great save, but you just want De Bruyne, a hat-trick of that quality. I couldn't think of a great, a brilliant hat-trick since Bergkamp. You know, Phil Foden, if our team was a Christmas dinner, Kevin De Bruyne would be the gravy. Every day of the week, smooth as you like. Liam said, who would be gravy on the pod? I think the smoothest is probably Paul Doyle.
Oh yeah, good shout.
Who would be the sprout? Langdon for irony purposes. Roger said, should Sterling be credited with an assist for ducking out the way of De Bruyne's shot? Is he the best midfielder in the Premier League?
Yes, I think so. You could maybe even go further. And I mean, there can't be too many better in the world. I wouldn't have thought. I felt that when he sort of came back from injury this season, that would make Manchester City better. And I think individually, he's been fine. Obviously, the issues for them have been in a more further back defensively. But yeah, fantastic, can do absolutely everything in terms of that midfield role.
Such a pleasure. And kept going until the very last second in a game that was won and more than won, ultra won. And he was chasing, at one point, I think it was Maitland-Niles, on a nothing ball to the corner flag. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
Man City's next match away at Oxford United on Wednesday in the Carabao Cup quarter final to Stamford Bridge. It had been 5 defeats in a row for Bournemouth. They'd been carved up so easily at Liverpool and Spurs. Meanwhile, 4 defeats in 5 now for Chelsea with that 1-0 win for Bournemouth. Did Eddie Howe outwit Frank Lampard, Lars?
I'm not sure I'd say that, but it was good for Bournemouth because this season, Bournemouth have been slightly different. They have been slightly more conservative in the way they set up, and it hasn't always worked out well for them. In this game, it really did. I mean, Chelsea still had enough chances to win this game. With slightly more good fortune or cool heads in front of goals, it would have been fine. But it's an important win for Bournemouth, who had been on a bit of a dreadful run.
One huge save from Aaron Ramsdale. Emerson could arguably, Mark, have headed that anywhere else, couldn't he? I mean, he really went for power, which is quite, with a ball that's got no pace on it, to really head it hard. Hullet did it in the 88 final, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't think Emerson is quite in the same quality as
Rude Hullet.
Fair enough,
it's the first time he's been compared to Rude Hullet.
Yeah. I disagree with last slide. I mean, I know Chelsea had some chances, but I didn't feel like Ramsdale was, you know, making the kind of saves that you would expect of an underdog goalkeeper at Stamford Bridge. You know, it wasn't a battering. I felt that it was very stodgy, really, from Chelsea midfield. They missed Kovacic because Bournemouth allowed the Chelsea centre-backs to have the ball whenever they wanted it and just marked Jorginho. Mm. And obviously, with Conte there, it's slightly different to when Jorginho is in alongside Kovacic and the two of them can sort of play out. And afterwards, Frank Lampard mentioned the fact that it was very slow from full-back, centre-back, centre-back, full-back, which in the Pep Confidential book, Guardiola speaks quite strongly on that's the worst type of possession you can have, that U-shape that just goes round the back four. And Chelsea had that going on, and they'll be feeling the pressure slightly now because this was a team that had a double-digit lead over Tottenham, you know, only when Mourinho came in, and now they head to Spurs on Sunday knowing if they lose, they're outside of the top four for Christmas.
So is Chelsea midfield the only people in West London to have billing problems?
Very good. Very good.
I'm wondering if it's not to do with the fact that what Lampard has from his players from the first day of the season, which is an ultra-high tempo with a young team, and that has worked and will work again. But I think they're just, at the moment, they look a bit jaded. They look a bit tired. And suddenly the runs, I mean, Kovacic, the other thing that he brings is that he carries the ball extremely well. He can go past tackles. Mm. He can accelerate. He can do all these things. Mm. And I think they're showing a little bit of tiredness as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you'd said to them, Chelsea fans, you'd be fourth and in the last 16 in the Champions League mid-December, they'd have taken it. I was on the radio with Andy Jacobs yesterday, goes to Chelsea week in, week out, and he's quite a catastrophist, but he says Willian is hopeless, and he says pundits don't see it, he says they never watch, but if you watch week in, week out, he's rubbish. And he says an issue with Chelsea is their old players are too old and their young players are too young.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
Willian, I think our friend, is a little bit on the pessimist side here.
Could this just be the Jonathan Wilson's frequently predicted reckoning for Frank Lampard?
That eventually
would be a reckoning earlier this autumn, and
I still think they're where they are,
Wilson reckoning.
And since the ban has been lifted, and afterwards Lampard was sort of saying, look, you know, they were, he was making the sort of comments that would justify spending a lot of money on a couple of players over Christmas.
It's a delicate position, though, isn't it? Because you've kind of trusted these young players. If you then suddenly buy another right winger and you block Hudson-Odoi's path to the first team, and you buy a striker that, that knocks Abraham out of the centre forward slot, that maybe sort of isn't the, the kind of message that Chelsea were trying to send out at the start of the season, and what Lampard as kind of the success has been built on. So you're trying to promote these young players. So I think it's a really tricky way. When you haven't, when you've got the transfer ban, it's in some ways it's easier because there isn't a decision to make. Now they're in this halfway house here of, do they improve the team but maybe block the path to some of these younger players?
But I think we're all talking earlier in the season, oh, it's great they're giving the young players a chance. You got to still do that when they're not winning every game. Like, it's not just about, like, you can't just be, oh yeah, young players, they're great when you win every game, and then when you lose a couple, it's, oh no, let's sign Icardi. It's like, you get that, that's not how you do it. And I think just looking at this season, the target is getting into the Champions League, and with Arsenal and United both being in a bit of a mess, they've still got decent chance. I mean, Spurs are kind of creeping up behind them now, which is a concern, but you'd still fancy their chances with the squad they have now, maybe.
Great win for Bournemouth. Their third win at Stamford Bridge since they were promoted in 2015. No side has won more at Stamford Bridge in that time. That's quite extraordinary stat.
Good
it?
VAR.
And yeah, the VAR was interesting, wasn't it? Because everyone says that the emotion, it takes the emotion out of celebrating. It didn't take the emotion out of Dan Gosling. You know, he was, he was over the moon, wasn't he? Yeah, and after the game, he said it made it even more special.
Yeah, and it's
there
also
should be longer delays.
Yeah, and it's also said that VAR is the enemy of goals. In this case, it saved a goal, so that was good.
Chelsea haven't picked up a single point from a losing position this season. Next for Chelsea, as you said, Mark, Spurs at White Hart Lane at the weekend. That'll be fun, won't it? To Old Trafford then. Manchester United 1, Everton 1. Mason Greenwood saved the day for United. The main story is all about Duncan Ferguson here. Moise Kean came on in the 70th minute. He was taken off in the 88th. Ferguson's quotes: "I just wanted to make a change to waste some time. I've got so many strikers on the bench." A couple of questions. I didn't notice that Kean wasn't playing particularly well, or wasn't playing brilliantly either. No. The reaction afterwards, it didn't seem when he came off that Ferguson sort of shook his hand and hugged him and said, "Look, I'll explain later," which optically would have been good, because so far the press has been very good for Duncan Ferguson. He's done everything sort of right in the 2 weeks he's been at Everton. Lots of people saying this is really poor management. Is it, isn't it, or is it hard to speculate without knowing how they interact?
I think that's the key bit, is what happened in the dressing room maybe afterwards. I mean, you can do that bit for show, can't you, where you give him a cuddle and try to explain, a bit like Mourinho did with Eric Dier. I mean, the decision's still the same, and you know, you are doing it for the cameras, I think, rather than you know, for anybody else. But it didn't look good. It didn't feel like a legitimate excuse really either, because there were other players that could have been substituted in that situation that wouldn't have impacted on the team. You are almost certainly going to damage a young talent that's kind of in a miserable spot anyway.
Having said that, there's 2 minutes left. You've got a point at Old Trafford. Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin are playing well, right? And they might be tired, and it is only 2 minutes. But if you've got to make a sort of brutal footballing decision, that might be the right footballing decision. And then it's how you deal with it afterwards, even though we don't see it very often.
No, I disagree. Okay. I think that Richarlison or Calvert-Lewin could quite easily have come off in that situation. Nobody would have pointed the finger at Duncan Ferguson that they lost the game in those last 2 minutes. I mean, it's a pretty normal thing for a manager to do, 2 minutes to go Old Trafford, where you take off, you know, a forward player to waste time. You just wouldn't normally do it to the young kid that you just brought on.
I think that from his perspective, Keane, if he's being taken off instead of, say, Calvert-Lewin, who's been running around all day, and Richarlison, who's been running around all day, Richarlison, who seemed to pick up a knock at one point as well. Like, I know it seems weird, and surely, if we take Duncan Ferguson's statements at face value, I think it's very strange that he doesn't seem to comprehend that that's quite a humiliation for a young man who doesn't seem settled to begin with. It's clearly, this is very, seems to me, from the outside of things, the big caveat being that things can be completely differently in the inside of the club, seems to be like a young guy who needs his confidence to be built up rather than anything, and this seems like a wanton act of destruction rather than anything else.
And it could be and should be a very important player for Everton. He's a very classy player. He's a huge talent, but I think as well, he's part of the kind of something I don't like, actually, the old alpha male show by Duncan Ferguson, wearing your heart on the sleeve, which is basically wearing this wristband that he used to wear when he was a player, having the watch that Alex Ferguson, Howard Kendall's widow gave him, all these things, taking the jacket off and so that he's soaked with the rain. Okay, that might be okay for, on a kind of paintball course, but I find it actually pretty unpleasant. It's a style of management which some people will think is probably what Everton needs at the moment, possibly up to a point, but this is very much for show as well.
Because I bought into it. Maybe I'm an idiot.
No.
Not a substitution, but just a whole...
I mean, the show, it works certainly in the two games. Look at the results.
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, you can't deny that. Obviously, he's had you wanted an electric shot. You've got it. But there is one point. This is where you realise he'll never be more than an interim manager for two or three games, because this is not the way you manage a club.
Having said all that, and we've spoken about this one incident, I think it's worth crediting Everton for getting anything out of this. Obviously, United have had problems all season against teams who sit back and let them have the ball. They look clueless. They don't look like they know how to open them up. It's not a new criticism. But from Everton's point of view, like, they go into any time when you go into a game at Old Trafford and you have one fit central midfielder and you have to play like Mason Holgate in midfield and like two centre forwards and Iwobi and Bernard as sort of 4-4-2 wingers, like, this is not a good situation for a coach to come into a game. And I thought it was a very determined and dogged performance by them, and they deserve credit for that.
Should Everton's goal have stood?
I think it should have stood, but I was surprised that it did. I mean, I
think Calvert-Lewin's arm is affecting De Gea there. It's above him, and that is a foul.
When I saw it on replay, I assumed it was going to be chalked off because that is nearly always seen as a foul. And I think Duncan Ferguson mentioned that afterwards, that in today's game, that probably is a foul. So I was surprised. But just on Lars's point there, Manchester United have taken 13 points in matches against teams currently above them in the table, and 12 points from those below them. So it's 13 from 15 and 12 from a possible 36 below, which is incredible, really.
Seven goals for Mason Greenwood this season. Sancho and Martinelli, the only teenagers in Europe's big five leagues with more goals. And the best news for Greenwood is he's now so high profile that the Athletic have gone to meet people in cost cutters near where he grew up.
When I saw that message, I thought that was done that?
They've done that, yeah. And the man in the cost cutter said, I was expecting you. That was the thing. That's funny.
Top content. The Athletic has been good, to be fair.
No. That's sort of a peak Athletic. Aaron Wan-Bissaka, amazing at tackling, which is something that we never really focus on, actually. I don't remember the last time I talked about someone good at tackling on the pod. But
yeah, and which came as a bit of a surprise, because when you started, I think, with Roy Hodgson at Crystal Palace, they had no idea that he could tackle like that. It is something he discovered, this ability to tackle, which is absolutely phenomenal.
But he goes to ground in the box, and you're like, what are you doing? Oh, he's it's all right.
Fine. He's in control.
Yeah.
But there was one, I think it was in the 80-something minute, that minute when like he went to ground in the box, and you always worry, like, when a player slide tackles in the box, you go, oh no, this is not smart. But it was a brilliantly executed tackle, got up with the ball, then played a really bad long pass, so it went straight back to Everton, so they were under pressure again. The ball came back into the box, he did another perfect tackle, and I felt like that was like a minute of peak Wan-Bissaka right there.
So it means a bit like the fireman who's also an arsonist.
But like, you know, this was such a... I feel like we didn't learn a lot of new things about United here. This was just all the same problems we've seen the whole autumn. And in games when they can counterattack, they look super dangerous. In games when it becomes about opening up the opponent, about showing guile, patience, vision, this sort of thing, they struggle. And you go through the names on the team sheet. I mean, these are the players they have, and there's not a whole lot of guile there, I guess you could say. But at one point, you do also wonder, from the manager's perspective, he should perhaps be helping them finding solutions, and in terms of what they do tactically and that sort of thing. I mean, it's
what do you think a manager's for, Lars?
When you keep dropping points in the same way, I mean, that's the problem, right? I mean,
Man United back in action. Is that the first time Lars has openly criticised his Norwegian brother?
Absolutely is not.
There it is. They're back in action on Wednesday against Colchester in the Carabao. Everton host Leicester should be a good one. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Anfield. Anfield. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly live shows. Lars, you're coming to Leeds with me on Friday, along with Wilson and John Bruin.
I'm bring some Eric Backer trivia.
Excellent news. That's what we all want. That's a sellout. We'll see you there. 20th of January, tickets still available in Brighton. Me, Barry Ellis and Nikki. 28th of January, a few more tickets for Dublin. And March the 9th and 10th, we're in Glasgow on the 9th. At the University Debating Chambers, the Pleasance Theatre in Edinburgh on the 10th, lineup TBC, and the tickets go on sale on Thursday. To Anfield, Liverpool 2, Watford 0, 16 wins out of 17, 10 points clear at the top of the table. Should we talk about the genius that is Mo Salah for a little bit, Philippe?
We can. It's always a pleasure.
The first goal, I thought he'd let the ball run away from him a little bit, and that finish.
And I thought he had turboed it, but not at all.
Oh, total genius. And the second finish as well, just...
It's the way he takes it as well, the little step, and it was like the dancing step. It's absolutely glorious to see. I mean, there were also other things. There was another shot that he did. He has this capacity of pirouetting in a very, very small space and keeping absolute balance and being able to, with almost no backlift, to give a lot of power to the ball. Absolutely wonderful to watch.
Great assist from Origi for the second one there.
Well, it's I mean that is one of those cliches about top of the league, bottom of the league. Decore did the same thing in the first half and it didn't go to a Watford player. And then Sarr completely spooned it. I mean, to the point where I was watching going, had I been sort of quantum leap style swooshed into his body and said, oh boy, I think I'd have connected better than Sarr did with that chance.
It was no De Bruyne finish, was it? I think it's fair to say.
I think it was. On the second goal, Thomas Bjorn sent this tweet. You know,
Friend.
Ryder Cup captain.
A bit random.
Can someone explain to me why Liverpool's second goal was checked by VAR on the defender next to Salah? There was a Watford defender lying on the byline on the other side of the goal at Max Rushton. So he comes to me. His question is not ridiculous because he didn't know about the sort of the goalkeeper being included.
I'm just not surprised that you are Thomas Bjorn's go-to guy for referee trivia.
Well, it's probably because you were on the pod last. So.
It's two players and the keeper.
Yeah,
is,
this is the thing. It's not it's because the goalkeeper is further out.
I would just like, I'm just encouraging more Ryder Cup heroes. If they have footballing questions, I'm here to answer them. Thomas Bjorn had a big fight with Barry, didn't he? And I took Thomas Bjorn's side on Twitter, and it's lots of fun. And now Thomas Bjorn is a better friend of mine than Barry Glendenning. The Mane header, right? The offside armpit. No one wants to see that, do they? FA and UEFA, we talked about it on Thursday, are going to have a conversation. As Jonathan Wilson pointed out, they'll get it wrong how they change it, but they should change it, shouldn't they?
Yeah, no. As the sort of the defender of VAR on this podcast, I think that's my sort of generally role in the world now. I'm not a fan of the sort of body part offsides at all. I don't see how the attacker gains any kind of advantage, and it just looks silly.
Lars, you'll know this. MLS, I've heard they use their eyes.
You know, they don't really do VAR for offsides, which sometimes is annoying because they do miss some offsides when you feel like they have the technology to.
So what, they don't look at they don't do it at all, or what I understood was they would have looked at that and gone, yeah, it looks onside to me, crack on.
Producer Sammy, I'd very like to double check this because I'm not entirely certain.
Okay, fine.
But I'm almost 100% certain that the way they use VAR is that they just take obvious incidents and fix them.
Mark, Watford could have got something from this game, couldn't they?
Yeah, they could. I thought that Nigel Pearson set them out quite adventurously and it was very positive, and that had been one of the complaints about Kike Sanchez Flores, that he was very negative in the way that he approached Watford's relegation battle. And they've only scored 9 goals and they've still only scored 9 goals, but they created enough chances to legitimately have sort of taken a point at least from Anfield. Delafoe missed a one-on-one as well, although it was a very good save. It wasn't probably much more he could do. I think if they play like that for the rest of the season, it gives them hope. The only thing I would say is that sometimes it's easier to play like that in a game where you're not expected to win and you can, you know, be very positive. It's the home game against Southampton or whatever where suddenly you need to win and do you play in the same manner. But I think that there was hope there for Watford. It was a good performance.
I think one of their other problems is they don't have very many points.
that is an issue.
It is an issue. I thought Ismaila Sarr was kind of he got a lot of stick from this game, obviously, because he had that one really bad miss, and there was a bit of him sort of tracking back and putting in a bit of a meek challenge that was flagged up on Match of the Day and this sort of thing. But yeah, overall, he did some good work here and was someone who was at least trying things and was not afraid to have a go at the opponents. And I think he's a player who there's more to come from.
I got quite a bit of flack for saying that Liverpool won against the run of play, but I stand by it. I genuinely think Watford were the better team on the day, and they conceded two goals to an absolute genius. And but otherwise, they looked to me better organised, they looked more energetic. When they were not in possession, they were not put in any trouble. Christian Cabasele had an absolutely magnificent game at centre-back. And I also thought that also the way Nigel Pearson reacted after the game was very calm. The way he talked, I thought this is very impressive.
The all-new Nigel Pearson, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. He's a fine manager. Yeah. We know that. And he's probably exactly the manager they needed.
Liverpool's next in action on Tuesday. They go to Aston Villa in the Carabao Cup.
Did you say they were in action? Have you seen the team they're sending? It's extraordinary. I didn't know a single player.
Well, Elliot says, should Liverpool be allowed to bring back ex-players for their Carabao Cup game? Maximum of three. Get in Jan Molby.
Jan Arnaiz is all up and ready for that.
Risa will be
still in fine
shape.
Nick, Jan Arnaiz.
Jimmy Traore.
Yeah, perfect. Their first team played Monterrey in the FIFA Club World Cup semi-final. They flew out to Qatar yesterday. In the US, MLS, VAR is used for only clear and obvious errors. That extends to offside. If the video official isn't certain after a quick check of the replay, the game goes on, much like cricket's method of sticking with the umpire's call on marginal LBWs.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for that.
Yep. Absolutely perfect. To the King Power, Leicester 1, Norwich 1. Leicester dropped points after that great winning run. People were starting to say, Mark, that they could still catch Liverpool. Is that done now? Was it done before?
I felt like it was done before, really. I mean, Leicester's primary aim this season will have been to sort of crack the top six and that at the start. Now it's very much about securing a top four finish in Champions League football. They should do that, but I don't think it was ever realistic to envisage them catching Liverpool. I think probably the only reason people were suggesting it is because they did it before, you know, and won that miracle title.
And but, we want it to happen.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. But I felt like, you know, Leicester had been winning games where on expected goals and expected points, they were kind of punching above their weight anyway. So I would prefer, I think, here to focus on Norwich as well, because it was a really good performance from a team that I think most people have got down as sort of, you know, real relegation candidates and will be going down. They played well, and I think had Pukki not broken his toe, they had opportunities in that second half to maybe have won the game as well. So a really good performance from Norwich.
It's an interesting thing about Leicester. I was doing some previews, and one of the things that struck me was the fact that he had very much stuck to the same 11 since the beginning of the season. He'd found a really good way of playing them, 4-1-4-1, basically. He tried something different with Iheanacho last weekend, which worked. But in this particular case, Iheanacho was completely, I mean, lost. And then suddenly you realise, why did you change that against Norwich when, you know, you've got this with Ayoze Perez and Barnes on the pitch? You looked such a better side than you did against Norwich. They didn't look quite as trenchant, and it's not as if they've got a huge number of games, though it might be that they really want to have a run in the League Cup, because he's actually put a very strong team last time round, and they wonder whether this competition, which by the way has been a good one for Leicester in the past,
true,
could be their way to some
Claridge could score the winner. It would have been nice to have a body cam on Iheanacho after he'd gone down when he'd played on, just to see the sort of horde of Norwich players standing over him. And look, fair play to Timo Pukki, breaking your toe and still playing. I mean, toes are quite important in football in my experience, and that is really quite brave. What Lars, should Leicester do in January? Their recruitment has been so good for so long. Roger said they won't sell anyone.
Yeah. No, if they can hold on to anyone, that's great. Everyone, that's great. And it's not just that they're good this season. It's that if you look at that team, like Vardy and Johnny Evans aside, they're a pretty young team. Like most of them are sort of in their mid-20s. So it's not just that I think they can do well this season, but they have every chance, if they keep them together, of building a group that can stay together and keep Leicester near the top on the table for a while. And then that sort of success, if you get into the Champions League for a couple of seasons, you make more money, so you have a better chance of keeping hold of people. It just kind of feels like Leicester are, with their team, not a million miles away from where Spurs were in the sort of early Pochettino or the second Pochettino season when the team was starting to fall into place. If they can keep hold of them, I think this is a very interesting team. I just note on the underlying numbers, I completely agree with with the esteemed Mr. Langdon about how the numbers for a very long time suggested that their form was unsustainable. But actually, in the last couple of weeks, their performances are like started catching up with the results, sure. If you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. They have actually been quite good. So I'm not as... It's easy to make a mistake when you look at like expected goals and underlying numbers, and I don't think that's what you did, Mark.
I think that's what he's saying you did, Mark.
I sound like a prat now, I'm sorry. It's more a general thing that...
Prates.
It's easy to look at if a team's overperforming their XG to think that that means a regression has to come. But what it just means is that if you keep producing the same number of chances, the regression will probably keep coming. But it's always possible for a team to start playing better, which is what Leicester has kind of done with the exception of this game. So I think they'll, you know, kick on and continue to be good.
Just like to thank any listeners who are still with us after that tactical based discussion. To Molyneux, Wolves 1, Spurs 2. Jose said, fantastic win, fantastic match, fantastic players, fantastic fans, fantastic referee,
fantastic manager,
fantastic Nuno and his staff. And I'm not saying fantastic Jose because I can't say fantastic Jose. Last minute winner from Jan Vertonghen and Wolves unbeaten run. Another away win for Jose. How Mark is Jan Vertonghen completely unmarked from that corner?
Well, it was. I think it was a combination of two things. First of all, he sneakily went up very late on. You had a word with Jose Mourinho, who sort of ushered him forward. I think there was conflict as to whether they should hold on for a point because it would have been a decent point away from home, or try to get the winner. Adama Traore, who had been brilliant in sort of the first 90 minutes, then had a dozy moment where he didn't pick Vertonghen up. And also felt that maybe Christian Eriksen surprised the Wolves defence, because any Spurs fan that's watched Spurs for a number of years, he always hits the first man at his corner. So to hit a deep one maybe caught Wolves out. I also felt... When a goal is scored via a header from beyond the penalty spot, that would concern me from a sort of defensive point of view as a whole unit, and maybe the goalkeeper. I know it skidded off the wet surface, but still, it was a long way out.
It was a very Sunday league goal. You see goals like that where the ball sort of bobbles in, and everyone's like, is that a goal? That's annoying. Look, before that, what a hit from Lucas Moura, an example of getting beaten at your near post and it not being your fault. And then Traore, you bowered that in. Who hit it harder for you?
I think Lucas Moura.
But what, two lovely goals.
Oh, absolutely wonderful. The Lucas Moura one is absolutely phenomenal, honestly. I mean, the way that's one thing I would say for Mourinho, is that the Lucas Moura we're seeing at the moment is really the very best Lucas Moura. He's playing in his right position. And my goodness, I mean, the acceleration and the power he generated on that, I just didn't know where you're going to stop this.
Interesting stat from Tim Spears from The Athletic on Traore. 26 appearances, 24 players booked for fouling him this season.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that, because that's also one thing that I thought during the Arsenal City game. I genuinely think it's time that tactical fouling is dealt with. It was a leitmotiv in the Arsenal City game from City, went completely unpunished. And Traore was rotating the strike. He was taken out three times by yellow card tackles, which should be orange tackles, to be honest. It should be sin bin.
Yeah.
There has to be a way, because it's ridiculous. It's really anti-football.
I mean, the Eric Dier one, for instance, I mean, there was no attempt to play the ball whatsoever. And you see players sent off for putting their face into each other, and that's nothing really. I mean, and you see almost every game now where Guendouzi on Zaha would the rugby tackle or whatever. I feel like it could quite easily be upgraded to a red in time.
I like the rule they have in Gaelic football where you can give a black card, which is given to a player who's committed a cynical foul, and each team is allowed to replace the first three who receive a black card.
So Eric Dier would have to be subbed.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the player has to go off, but you can replace him for the first three, and until you're just taking
I like both of those.
Because red cards just alter the balance of a game so much, and it. I know, I completely agree that it should be stricter for fouls that are completely cynical, but then you force the referee into a situation where they have to make a judgment call. There are a lot of times where players can just stumble into someone and it can end up being a cynical challenge, and then you get red carded and the whole game changes. I mean, it creates a big and dangerous grey zone. So something like a sin bin or a black card situation would be good.
To St Mary's, Southampton 0, West Ham 1. Sebastian,
we just said that Wolves were brilliant, by the way. We have the right to say. I mean, Wolves,
we do, yes.
Yeah. They're wonderful to watch at the moment. They're really getting there to the top of their form.
And I think you saw that. Jose Mourinho did a knee slide, didn't he? When Vertonghen scored, he sort of recreated
it was a humble Nieslander. Yeah.
It's one of the great sort of plot lines of the season is Mourinho, you know, trying to keep this humble thing going. Like, how long?
Southampton 0, West Ham 1. Sebastian Haller's goal, his first in the Premier League since October. He went 636 minutes without scoring. Antonio was excellent for West Ham. How big a victory is this for Pellegrini, Philippe?
Very big indeed, because it looks as if in the end he's going to be kept until at least after Christmas, which honestly, if you were at West Ham Tottenham, was not an obvious thing at all. But I find this West Ham team very strange, because they had quite a convincing win, just the same way they had a very convincing win at Chelsea. And then the next game, they completely lose it again, completely. It's not even up and down. It's not yo-yoing. I don't know what it is. It's yin and yang, completely binary. It's a team for our times.
Yeah. Who would you rather watch out of West Ham and Southampton? Or does it depend on what West Ham turn up?
Oh, I think it depends on both of them, because Southampton have been really good in some matches, particularly when they're not expected to win at Man City away. They lost very late on at Arsenal. It was a bonkers game that they probably still can't believe they haven't got 3 points from that. And then when the onus is on them to win, they seem to struggle with that, and they crept over the line in a couple of those sort of relegation battles, but they were terrible against Everton a few weeks ago, and really poor first half. And they improved a little bit after the break when he made the substitution. Romeo came on for Redmond, but I find them a very odd team to work out.
Sheffield United 2, Aston Villa 0. Sheffield United up to 7th. John Fleck's 4th goal in 4 games at Bramall Lane. I think that might be his first ever brace. Chris Wilder said Dean Smith and John Terry were in the tunnel clapping our players because they recognise our players' performance today. That's a class act. And people won't see it, but I want to mention it. Grealish missed a late penalty. Villa have now missed both penalties they've been awarded this season. Sheffield United impress all over the pitch, don't they? But a good question from Jez. Has there ever been a more loved striker that hasn't scored than David McGoldrick at Sheffield United? The fans understand that he had so much in the build-up to the team. 30,000 fans chanting his name throughout the game versus Villa. He still can't score, but we don't care. It will come.
Kesman at Chelsea. The Chelsea fans really took to Kesman, and I never understood why, really. Mourinho even said, like, only in England would a striker who doesn't score sort of be so loved by the fans. I think it was the industry that he used to put in.
Yeah. I'm French. I'm from the country of Stéphane Guivarch. No, what can I say?
Burnley 1, Newcastle 0. Chris Wood's head of the difference between these two sides at Turf Moor. Both sides have over 20 points before Christmas. You'd imagine they'd both be okay with that, certainly Steve Bruce. Full of Christmas cheer, the big story from this game, Sean Dyche and Steve Bruce both having a pop at referee Tim Robinson on his first Premier League game. Steve Bruce says, I understand how difficult it is, but for me, Burnley versus Newcastle on a day like today, is it really the right occasion for him to make his debut? To which you go, yes, I think it probably is. I'm sorry, but it didn't look quite right from the first whistle. What do you want him to have? Man United, Man City? What? Who? Liverpool City? You know, for the title decider. Dyche saying, if you're going to blood these people into the highest division, which needs to happen, why is it only our games? Why is it not the big games? If they're deemed good enough for the Premier League, then put them in the big games.
What did he do wrong, Tim Robinson, referee? I mean, it was a corner which he initially gave as a goal kick. He corrected his error. It wasn't a foul. It was a dive by the Newcastle defender. I can't remember which one. And then Burnley scored from the resulting corner.
If you're going to bring him in, to be honest, what you should do is once you've earn your spurs in the Football League, the first game you should do is something sort of like the Champions League final, maybe the World Cup final. Crack straight in. Tonight is the M23 derby. Crystal Palace host Brighton. Big derby game, isn't it? Roy Hodgson's 100th game in charge of Palace. His renaissance since England has been a joy, I think, for everybody, hasn't it?
It's a sort of avian derby. The Eagles and the Seagulls.
Yes. I thought you were making a comment about Roy Hodgson looking like an owl.
Absolutely.
Well, does that as well?
It's very avian down there. In the Football League and the Championship, Leeds threw away. Did you just make. Who did that?
Who was last? A Norwegian albatross.
I know it's early now.
Albatross is Southern Hemisphere, so I don't want to be careful.
Sounds like some sort of crow saying var, anyway. This pod really has descended.
Seagull.
I know we have a substitute producer in today, so you know you can misbehave. But honestly, love, grow up.
Substitute producer who looks like Håvard Nordtveit, which I'm a big fan of.
Okay. That's a good one for the listeners. In the Football League, in the Championship, Leeds threw away a 3-goal lead at half-time at home to Cardiff. The Leeds correspondent, Phil Hay, from The Athletic, tweeted at half-time, "This is different level stuff. You win 7 games on the spin, then find another gear to turn in a first half like that. Cardiff can't live with it, and the Championship aren't really living with it either." One of those football tweets that precedes unfortunate incidents if you're a Leeds fan. A wonderful assist from Lee Tomlin. As producer Sammy says, there's something about footballers named Lee being a bit chubby but having a touch of genius. I've only got Trundle in my head. I can't think of any other Lees. Lee Chapman was in Reasonable Nick, wasn't he? Lee Sinnott. I can't remember how fat or thin he was. I just know his name.
Sammy Lee.
Yeah, I suppose so. West Brom remained top after edging a 5-goal through away at Birmingham City. Charlie Austin's second half double, clinching all 3 points for the Baggies. Below that, Brentford leapfrog rivals Fulham after a convincing 1-0 win. Sheffield Wednesday also moved into the playoffs after they thrashed fellow hopefuls Nottingham Forest 4-0 at the City Ground. Game of the day, 21,701 fans at the Bet365. Stoke 0, Reading 0, no shots on target. That is what football should be, right? In League One, Wickham remained top after they beat mid-table Burton 2-0. Increased the gap on Ipswich to 7 points after they lost 2-1 at home to Bristol Rovers. At the bottom, MK Dons picked up their first win in 3 months and their first under boss Russell Martin after beating Oxford 1-0. In League Two, 8 of the 12 games ended in draw, a joint record for the division. Leaders Swindon, second-placed Exeter, did both pick up wins over Salford and Oldham. Cambridge remain in 11th after a stunning 1-1 draw at Cheltenham. In the WSL, Arsenal stayed top after they beat Everton 3-1, but Beth Mead was stretched off with what appears to be a serious leg injury. Manchester City are up to second after a 5-0 thrashing of Brighton. A poor result for Chelsea, though. They could only pick up a 1-1 draw against struggling Liverpool. They remain unbeaten, though, and are now 4 points behind leaders Arsenal. And Fitbar Corner. Rangers picked up their first win in 4 games after beating Motherwell 2-0. Alfredo Morelos sent off for gesturing to fans after scoring his side's second goal. Steven Gerrard said he has no complaints about the sending off, but believes Don Robertson was desperate to give out a red card, which sounds like he did have some complaints, didn't it? Celtic stayed top after a 2-0 win over Hibs at Celtic Park. Odson Edouard and Jeremy Frimpong got the goals for Celtic, 2 points clear of their Old Firm rivals. That'll do for part 2. Part 3 will begin with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, tremendous. Barcelona, Real Madrid, first and second, tied on 35 points. Neither of them won.
Yeah, and that was sort of predictable in the sense that they were both playing really, really difficult games. Real Madrid away at Mestalla against Valencia, Barcelona away at Real Sociedad, and both of them were fantastic as well. Both of them really, really open games, lots and lots of chances for both teams. Barcelona were 1-0 down, 2-1 up, finished 2-2, had a big penalty shout in the last minute. Real Madrid were 1-0 up, it went to 1-1. They really should have gone 2-1 down in the 92nd minute, but then they get a chance from a corner in, and I'm going to tell you now because I've got it written down here somewhere, 94 minutes and 23 seconds the corner comes in. Thibaut Courtois goes up for it. Zidane says after the game, yeah, it was his decision, it wasn't us, he decided to go up. Courtois says, look, I'm 2 metres tall and that frightens people when you go up, which of course is true. Carlos Soler, the Valencia midfielder, says, well, he's a goalkeeper, so of course he's got no one marking him because it's not part of the plans. Courtois jumps in a huge crowd of players, heads it towards goal. Jaume Domenech spills it. It's kind of like a little bit of a kind of a moment where everyone sort of stops and goes, where's it gone? It hits a player's heel who effectively backheels it into the path of Benzema, who scores pretty much the last kick of the game. I think they have time for the centre and nothing else. And Madrid got a huge 1-1 draw, which I think emotionally as much as anything else is important for them. And it means they go into the Clásico level on points.
Yeah, and that is a huge game now, isn't it, on Wednesday?
Yeah, massive. I mean, obviously, look, the Clásico is always huge. And I went through and did the stats the other day, and it's never a good idea when I start doing calculations. But I worked it out, and it was something like the way that the Clásico always feels like it shapes the season. And actually, if you look at the result of the first Clásico and who comes out of it on top of the table, I think for each of, I think it was 12 of the last 15 years, I think, the team that's come out of the Clásico, the first Clásico, top of the table, has gone on to win the league. Obviously, one of the years when that didn't happen was when Atletico Madrid won it. So obviously, by definition, neither of them could have done. So in the times when it was one or the other, it was, you know, what's that, 12 of 14. And so it really does have an impact. And this time it feels like it even more so because they're close together. They're both playing reasonably well now. They're starting to get things right. It feels like the momentum's building. And also, of course, you add to that that it's pretty much the last game before Christmas. It's not. There's one more after it. But it feels like everything's been building for this now because of the fact, of course, that the original Clasico date was postponed.
And also because, despite the fact that all this season we've said, oh, look, could we have a three-team or a four-team or a five-team title race, everyone else seems to be slipping a little bit. Sevilla losing at the weekend.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you know, Atletico Madrid have really struggled for goals. They won 2-0 this weekend, which is really big for them. But they'd only won 1-8 before the Champions League victory against Lokomotiv in midweek. And you know, even when we had that really tight table, of course, we had the little asterisks, if you like, by Real Madrid and Barcelona, who hadn't played as many games as everyone else because the Clasico had been cancelled. And what's happened, which I suppose was predictable up to a point, is that they've started to get it right and started to pull away, and others have started to get caught out. Now, Sevilla being beaten this weekend was a bit of a surprise, but I think some of the other results probably haven't been.
Sid, lovely to speak to you. We'll speak to you before you get your big hams out for Christmas, I'm sure.
Hope so. Speak to them.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. In Germany, RB Leipzig climbed to the top after they won 3-0 away at Dusseldorf. Borussia Mönchengladbach dropped to second after a 2-1 away defeat at Wolfsburg. England's Jadon Sancho, just in case you didn't know, scored for the sixth consecutive game as Borussia Dortmund hammered Mainz 4-0. Biggest winners of the weekend, Bayern Munich, who thumped strugglers Werder Bremen 6-1 at the Allianz. From Germany to Italy now, here is a roundup from Nicky Bandini.
Well, this was a weekend slightly dominated by a pair of 19-year-olds in Serie A, Dusan Vlahovic and Dejan Kulusevski. Vlahovic scored a brilliant solo goal in injury time for Fiorentina to earn them a point in a game that they had no business getting anything from against Inter. Fiorentina were a goal down and defending down by their own corner flag, where they'd spent a lot of the game in the 92nd or 93rd minute. Dalbert just gets a half clear to Vlahovic, who turns on the burners and carries it 50 yards before scoring into the top corner. Well worth a look if you haven't seen it. A lot of people already very excited about Vlahovic down in Florence. He started a bunch of games for them at centre forward, though this isn't necessarily the kind of goal I would have expected from him from what I'd seen so far. He's this tall, lean number nine who really looks good in the air, but yes, magical here with the ball at his feet as well. Definitely a result that hurts Inter. They were 2 points clear at the top of the table before. They're now back to sharing first place with Juventus, who won 3-1 against Udinese. That was a very one-sided game, but interesting for the fact that it's the first time this season that Maurizio Sarri has started all of Ronaldo, Higuain and Dybala together. So, of course, we're wondering now whether this is the start of a newer, more exciting and attacking Juventus than we'd seen from Sarri so far. The other teenager I mentioned, Dejan Kulusevski, he is on loan at Parma from Atalanta. He scored one goal and set up the other as Parma went away to Napoli. He's already, I'd say, had a bigger impact this season than Vlahovic. He really looks like he might be emerging as something quite special. Again, very sort of tall player, much more powerful, broad-shouldered build combined with some serious acceleration, and yes, just so imposing when he's running with the ball. He took advantage of Koulibaly's slip right at the start of this game, and actually, you know, again, going shoulder to shoulder with Koulibaly, and that which tells you something about how strong he is, before charging forward and finishing to give Parma an early 1-0 lead. Napoli did get back level, but then at the end of the game, Kulusevski again so quick to capitalise when another Napoli player loses their footing, races off, exchanging passes with Jovinho, who he eventually sets up for the winner. So that game, of course, was Gennaro Gattuso's first game in charge of Napoli after he replaced Carlo Ancelotti. So, sorry to say, no new manager bounce just yet for the man who was introduced at his press conference the other day as Ringo Starr.
Thank you, Nicky. To France, Philippe, PSG won. Extraordinary. 4-0 at Saint Etienne. 2 for Mbappe.
It was really unexpected. Quelle surprise. Quelle surprise.
They're now 7 points clear at the top of the league. Match was stopped after 89 minutes because the home fans set off fireworks inside the stadium after Kylian Mbappe's second goal. If you're going to indoor fireworks, presumably, you know, the tiny little worm. Do you remember that one? The little wormy sort of poo type one. The match was stopped after 89 minutes because the home fans set off fireworks inside the stadium after Kylian Mbappe's second goal. Second place Marseille's run of six consecutive wins came to an end as they could only pick up a 1-1 draw against struggling Metz. Lyon lost 1-0 at home to Rennes. Doesn't tell the whole story though, Philippe, does it?
No, it's absolutely awful. Catastrophic evening for Lyon. That's actually these are the words which were used by Juninho, the sports director of the club, afterwards, because they didn't lose one. They lost two very big players. Jeffrey Adelaide, whom people might remember from his short time at Arsenal, who's become an important player at Lyon, and especially, and that is really terrible for them, Memphis Depay. And it is feared that he has actually done his cruciate and that he's out for the rest of the season, which is a big problem for Lyon, also a big problem for the Netherlands, because he's absolutely essential to the way the Netherlands are playing. And he'd just been made captain. He was reveling in the role. He seemed to be playing better and better, more consistently than ever. And it's really awful for Lyon. And whoever actually gets them in the draw, the Champions League draw, I think you can already bet that this team will be in the quarterfinals. I mean, they are not in a good place at all.
It's so cruel, though, if this is actually the injury they've said they worry it is.
Yeah.
Because he's a player who obviously for a long time has shown flashes of just immense talent.
Exactly.
But has been completely infuriating. And I think this season there have been real signs that he's been coming of age. And when he was handed the captaincy, I think a lot of people went, like, what?
Yeah.
Like, Captain Memphis Depay seems really daft, but it seems like he's really grown with that responsibility.
And
he like behaved in a very captainly manner when the fans had a mean banner about Marcello. He went to grab the banner.
Yeah, making him look like a donkey.
Yeah, well, yeah. But like he went to grab the banner and like properly behaved as a captain should. And it seemed like Memphis was growing up. And
And some of the things Juninho said after the game are things which I think would be unthinkable in England. As in, he said basically, with him gone, that's our only leader gone. I look at the team and I only see very polite young men, but I don't see a single leader. That's the sports director of the team talking. So that doesn't augur well for what's going to come.
The Champions League draw will take place after we finished recording and before you listen. So be excited about the draw, and we'll talk about it on Thursday. We'll leave you with an update from Barry. Baz in India. Hashtag Baz in India has not trended, unbelievably. He says, I've shaved 14 minutes off my personal best for kayaking around Monkey Island in the Arabian Sea.
You actually gave me a fright here.
He said, I also watched an entire football match for the first time in 3 weeks. I can confirm Arsenal look as inept, projected onto a Flintstone-style screen hanging from a length of bamboo outside a beachside bar, as they do in real life. And that'll do for today. Philippe, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lars Siverton.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you to your crow friend as well. And thank you to Mark Langdon.
Thank you, Max.
We'll be back on Thursday.